How does the off-course golf impact the on-course golf? It's a great question. And a lot of operators and investors I've talked to are trying to solve this problem. Here's why is Topgolf is this huge funnel. Once somebody comes into a Topgolf and they get interested, how do we bring them down to play green grass golf? There's a gap. And I think lighted par threes are a little bit of a gap there. We're playing real golf, hitting real golf shots outside, yet it's under the lights possibly, or you could play in the day, but under the lights, and there's a community and entertainment aspect to it. Music, food, concerts, whatever it may be. So I think the lighted par three done right is a gap and a bridge from off-course to on-course golf right now.
Welcome back to the Golfers Journal podcast presented by Titleist, the number one ball in golf. My name's Tom Coyne. Thanks so much for joining us. And if you look at the recent results on tour, it's clear why Titleist is the number one ball in golf, with the Pro V1 and Pro V1X tallying four consecutive wins on the PGA Tour by Titleist players at the Century, the Sony, the American Express, and the Farmers, with 360 players teeing up a Titleist at those events more than five times the nearest competitor. So if the folks who are playing the game for a living trust the Titleist, it seems pretty good reason for us to trust Titleist as well. Now, there are more golf balls to choose from at Titleist than the Pro V1 and Pro V1X, so go to Titleist.com, click on fittings, and use the ball selector tool there to figure out which Titleist is going to give your game the results you're looking for. Now, on today's podcast, we are thrilled to welcome Jared Dorfler to the pod. Jared writes the Perfect Putt newsletter, which covers every angle of the golf business. And when it comes to money and trends and growth in the business side of golf, there is no better expert than Jared. I think you're really going to enjoy this wide-ranging discussion. We talk about everything from top golf to lighted and short courses and micro economies of golf resorts, plus the post-COVID boom state of golf right now, the explosion of off-course golf experiences going on out there. And we also get into ways that you might find your own place in the expanding golf landscape. Jared knows his stuff, and we appreciate him sharing his expertise in this conversation. But first, before we turn to Jared, some TGJ news to share. Number 27, that's the big news right now. Number 27 is out. It is here. Hopefully it has arrived in your... Let me turn it around here for folks watching on YouTube. Hopefully it's arrived in your mailbox. This one is packed. It's all bangers. From Charlie Wurzel to Ben Rector taking on Branson, Missouri, to a trip to Palmetto in South Carolina, one of my favorite golf spots on the planet, to an intimate study of the hands and grips of golf's biggest names. I mean, we've got Sweden in this one, plus some Tom Doak. And a trip to Anstruther in Scotland, where a local tells us how to play, or maybe try to play, the toughest par three in the world. 27 is a page turner. So if you don't subscribe, please go to golfersjournal.com now, and we'll get number 27 in the mail to you right away. Also, the event lottery for the Bridge, mark your calendars, is February 21st. The event is May 8th. This is a great event. I had a blast last year. I will be there this year for sure. It is circled on my calendar. A day at one of Long Island's most exclusive and certainly one of its most visually stunning golf courses. You get 18 holes of golf at the Bridge. You get a loop on the 5-hole short course designed by Brian Schneider. You get breakfast and lunch, beer provided by Golden Road Brewing, gifts from TGJ and our sponsors. Prizes and awards for low net and low gross. And with your entry, your caddy fee and gratuity are included. It is just an awesome day. And really, I've written about it in the book and elsewhere. And it is just one of the most unique spots in golf. So I hope to see you there. Thanks for listening. And huge thanks to all our members. Again, if your membership has lapsed, make sure you get current so we can get number 27 into your hands. Quiet, please. Now on the Golfers Journal podcast, Jared Dorfler and the business of golf. Jared, thank you so much for joining us and taking some time on the Golfers Journal podcast. I love what you do. I think you found a great, you're writing, I can't recommend your newsletter highly enough, perfectputtsubstack.com. Which gets into the business side of golf and all these sorts of cool ways and in which way, you know, people aren't thinking about that there's a business in that part of golf and a business in that part of golf. So I think you have a really comprehensive view of things, and it's a wonderful read. You break it down very clearly and succinctly. So really excited to have you on the podcast. So many things to talk about. First, tell us, where are you coming from?
Tom, thanks for having me. I'm in rural Iowa, Mason City, Iowa, about 2 hours south of Minneapolis, 2 hours north of Des Moines.
Outstanding. The heartland.
Yes.
And I don't want to give away too much here, but I would just say that there's a possibility that maybe the Golfers Journal event van might find its way maybe to that part of the country before too long. I'll say no more, but a beautiful part of the world, and I've played some golf out there and couldn't enjoy it anymore. Waveland in Des Moines, I think.
Oh, yeah. That's winner. An old golf course, fun golf course. You can make a lot of birdies.
So good. Maybe that's why I liked it. I don't recall if I made a lot of birdies, but you think of Des Moines and you don't think of land like that, but it's so great. So I want to hear about how you got into this. How did you get into golf and then find yourself writing about the business side of it?
Yeah, I got into golf when I was probably around 5 years old, I suppose. My dad taught me the game, and my parents' house was next to a cornfield. So my dad and I would hit some golf balls into the cornfield, and we would go pick them up. Of course, we are good friends with the farmers, and we didn't want to, make them too grumpy. So we picked up the balls, and then my dad actually taught me how to play at a rural 9-hole golf course in Iowa. And really, the rest is history. I fell in love with the game, like so many people do, and it's such a unique game in so many different areas. But what I really enjoyed growing up is playing with my dad and grandfather. And then I was able to play college golf at a small Division I school, University of Northern Iowa. And then after I graduated, I like a lot of people, I just put the clubs away for a while, other than like bachelor parties or something along those lines. And my wife and I lived in Kansas City for quite some time. And when we moved back to Iowa, I started playing again. So about that time, I was actually finishing my MBA, and I had an elective to burn. So I wanted to take entrepreneurship and innovation. And the instructor was like, "You guys need to write online. It's so important to write online." And I'm thinking to myself, Tom, like, that's not a good idea for me. And I'm not kidding when I say this. I barely passed freshman English. I'm like, I don't see myself as a writer. I don't think I'm a good writer. But, he made some salient points. So I took him up on it, and I'm like, okay, well, what am I going to write about? I love golf. I've got a huge passion for golf, and I love business. I'm always curious about different businesses, and entrepreneurs. And so I'm like, let's marry those two together. There's a lot of really good companies out there talking about business and sport, front office sports, etc. But no one's really niching down into golf. And so I'm like, let's just do that, thinking that I might be able to get like 100 people to read it on a weekly basis. And that was about 2.5 years ago. So I've been writing it for 2.5 years, and it's still relatively small. There's about 8,500 people that subscribe and read it. And so there's a good amount of room for runway to grow. And I thoroughly enjoy the research and the writing portion of it.
Well, you do a great job. Like I said, I mean, it's, going through your Substack and the newsletters, there's just something in there that just grabs your interest, and you're finding stuff that I didn't know about or didn't know that was happening in golf. And you're covering topics that people don't really associate and think about what's the business behind that. So many great topics I want to jump into today. Some that you've written about, and I'd love to dive in a little bit deeper. Maybe we can start with a recent post of yours about the micro economies created by golf resorts. I think this is super interesting, especially since there's just been this boom of destination golf places, with multiple courses where you go and spend a few days. I mean, it's happening all over. And but what is the actual economic impact of those places?
Yeah, and this was a really, really fun piece to write. And to preface this with a little context, I wrote 1,000 words on this, and I think that it can easily be 10 to 15,000 words, and I think it can be like a huge case study for the golf industry.
Are you pitching the Golfers Journal right now, Jared? Because I like it.
I think, honestly, to be done right, it would take like 3 to 6 months of full-time work to get this done. And I think it'd be really neat to, you know, go on site to some of these courses and talk to some of the management, and then also talk to local leaders in the county. University of Oregon did something akin to this probably 7 years ago or so with Bandon. And we can just start there with what Bandon's been able to do. So, you know, like in Coos County, where Bandon's located, it's a relatively small county. It's got 65,000 people. And what's interesting is that in the 50s and 60s, about 8,000 people were employed by the lumber industry. And that industry has declined greatly, you know, down to about 1,400 people. And this is what I think is most interesting about Coos County that involves Bandon. In 1998, Coos County's unemployment rate was 11.5%. So a year before Mike Kaiser opened Bandon in 98. And then today it's 3.9%. And I think that shows a lot about what Bandon's been able to do, not just their direct employment, but all of the other industries that are impacted. You know, Bandon has around 700 full-time employees, and they hope to get to 800 full-time employees, you know, in 2024. And that doesn't include caddies. They're the largest property taxpayer in the county. And so what Bandon has done, and I don't think this was the intention, but it's really neat to see, is that, you know, they came into kind of a distressed area from a county standpoint, and they've been able to be really good stewards of the land, but also really good stewards of the county. And I think that has welcomed them with a great partnership with local folks.
What do you know, when you talk about the other industries that are impacted outside of sort of the Bandon resort itself, what are those other industries that we don't think about that might benefit from these, you know, these golf getaways being there?
Yeah. So non-direct employees. So we're talking possibly lodging. So new hotels, Airbnb stays. There's even a micro like business industry that's popped up with transporting people from the airport to Bandon. Mm-hmm. A lot of these services, if you will, have really done an excellent job in supporting Bandon and the infrastructure that goes behind it.
Yeah, there's a lot to make that place run and to get you there, for sure.
Yeah.
What other resorts did you look at or are seeing any impact from?
Yeah, and coincidentally, you know, Sand Valley actually has a similar story. So, mm-hmm. You know, Sand Valley is in Adams County, Wisconsin. And in the 90s, they had over 40 paper mills, not in Adams County, but in the area. So relatively close. And now today, there's only five paper mills left in the area. So Sand Valley comes in, you know, they had a 7.2% unemployment rate in Adams County a few months before Sand Valley opened. Now they have a 4.2% unemployment rate in Adams County. They employ over 500 people. They're the largest employer in the area in Adams County. Sand Valley is, I believe, just scratching the surface of kind of really where they're at in maturity versus Bandon. And so I would expect those numbers to significantly increase or add more value to the local county in the future years.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, Sand Valley expanding in golf courses probably needs to expand in accommodation. And that's going to bring with it a lot of economic impact. I think it's a really interesting theme, though, this idea of golf not necessarily replacing, but helping in places where the primary industry is not as viable as it once was. I'm seeing that in where I'm working on a golf course in the Catskills, where the primary industry was tourism from New York City. When that left, trying to fill a little bit of a hole there with golf. At Stream Song, you had a left behind mine. Yep. That's an interesting case. Did you look at Stream Song or think about what's going on down there? Because that is a pretty remote spot, but all the people that work there, they have to live somewhere.
Yeah, we briefly looked at it, Tom, and we got to the point where it's like we found three really good ones to highlight. And with my newsletter, I don't try to really write over 1,000 to 1,200 words because it's just too much. And so Stream Song is absolutely an awesome use case for this. Cabot in Nova Scotia, same thing. in Nova Scotia, where Cabot's at, they had, I believe it was also a big mining town, and, you know, mm-hmm. they've been in basically recession for decades, and Cabot's helped with that, kind of bring that back to life. So it's just this weird play, and I think it's mostly coincidental because developers are going out to find incredible pieces of land that just so happen to be in these remote areas that unfortunately were impacted by industry. And they're able to, you're right, they're not necessarily replacing, but they're certainly supplementing and helping what it once was.
Yeah, it's great news all the way around. We saw Ben Cowan-Dewar, the man behind Cabot, along with Mr. Kaiser. But, you know, in talking with him about what happened up there in Nova Scotia, I think that was the thing he was most excited about were those numbers in terms of employment and where the area is now. It's a good story. Mm-hmm. Speaking of the PGA show, where we ran into the Cabot folks, among many others, were you down there this year?
I was. I made a quick trip. I wasn't even there for 24 hours, but it was a good show.
You can pack it all in. It was a good show. It had a lot of energy, a lot of new brands there, a lot of new stuff going on. Tell me about something from the PGA show that excited you or really caught your interest.
There's two things that I think caught my interest. I think are good for the industry. One is indoor golf simulators. That's not even remotely going away. That's only going to continue to get much bigger. I mean, we're going to start seeing different leagues pop up that are utilizing simulator technology. The technology continues to get better. And one thing, Tom, just a separate note on indoor golf here, and why I think that is because, you know, I'm in a place where tee times aren't an issue. But I've quickly found out that I am in the minority there. There's a lot of folks that have tee time issues mm-hmm. around the country. And there's a lot of folks that, you know, are now priced out of joining a country club. And I'll give you a quick example here is that when we were in Kansas City, my wife and I, right before we moved, we were actually going to join a country club, and it was $8,000 initiation fee. And the dues were very reasonable. That today, 6 years later, that country club is now $40,000 initiation fee. So a lot of folks are getting priced out. And so what that means is, people want to join something though, and they want to be a member of a community. And indoor golf actually provides that. It may not be the same thing, but you can play your round quicker. You can still join a community of folks. You can get a normal foursome in or whatever it may be. For a more reasonable price. So I'm really excited to continue to see where indoor golf and simulators go. And the other thing really for me is women's apparel. I think women's apparel is unique. There was a ton of mm-hmm. companies at the PGA show introducing new lines. For example, Roan, who's been in male athleisure wear for quite a while, introduced a women's line that will become available in May. And they partnered with the LPGA Tour and Epson Tour to be their on-course wear. Here's the thing about women's apparel is that I haven't seen anyone do anything like different yet.
Right.
And maybe we'll get there, but like I talked to my wife and, you know, and she's like, I still haven't seen anything different that sticks out. And so I think there's a really unique opportunity in women's apparel. It's one of the fastest cohorts in the game. Over 800,000 net new women have joined golf since 2019. So it is a significant opportunity.
Yeah, that's a great point. And still the rack in the pro shop in most places for the women is over in the corner, and it has a lame selection of stuff that my wife probably doesn't want. Meanwhile, over on the men's side, ooh, new hoodies, new this, new looks. Yep. So, yeah, that's got to be a huge growth area. And it was exciting to see at the PGA show. I thought apparel was the big winner at the show. There were like new brands, new, just a lot of buzz about that. I think it's interesting to see the show becoming sort of, the brands were younger. It was cool. The show's sort of going in that direction. Speaking of, I want to get back to, though, the off-course kind of golf and that indoor golf. What do you know the economics of how that's working out for any of these clubs that have grown up around that are offering the indoor experience sort of exclusively? I imagine it's pretty good. You know, once you pay for the, and I guess, and the price points must be coming down on these things. So, you know, mm-hmm. once you've got them in your system, I mean, we have a place here in Philadelphia, Scratch House, or is it Scramble House? I don't know. I'm not a member, but I would like to be. We're mm-hmm. in the off season, you know, it's like, you know, 30 simulators and a putting green, and it's become its own sort of golf society mm-hmm. there. So, and I don't think that those places are necessarily that unique anymore. Are they good investments? Do they make money?
So I'm biased in this, and I want to preface that, because I've been studying this for like a year and a half, and I'm just too afraid to pull the trigger in my town. So a couple of buddies and I got together, we put a business plan together, and what we expect, we wanted to do a fully private simulator model, right? And with key card entrance, and what we needed was 70 people to join to basically have a 30% gross margin. And that's definitely doable. Well, when we started talking about this, there was no simulators in our town, no companies. Since then, there's two. So I mean, I'm in rural Iowa. People want to play golf in the winter. It gets cold here. And so I think that the economics behind it are interesting. I think that F&B probably plays some role into it. But I just want to highlight, you know, three things, because I'm kind of giving you anecdotes, and I think it's better off if I give you some numbers, is we can just look at, you know, three recent acquisitions. So Foresight sold to Vista Outdoor for $474 million. Full Swing had $160 million investment by Bruin Capital. And then Skytrack sold to Golf Tech for $65 million. These are all in the last 2 years. And so there's a lot of investment acquisition going on in this space. And also, True Golf appears to have just done a SPAC as well, and their valuation's around $80 million. So there's a lot of interest in it from investors. I mean, you can really see why. If you just go on Google and you type in golf simulator, the Google search term was 47. Now, this is on a scale of 0 to 100. It was 47 in 2019. And in 2022, it was 78. In 2023, it was 100. So we're seeing significant growth for people searching for golf simulator setups, whether that's home, whether that's at a golf course, or whether that's, you know, at a small commercial location.
Yeah, I mean, they're popping up all over the place. Where I play, they just put in a new a new simulator experience. So for those of us who didn't get our MBA, Jared, tell us, what is a SPAC?
SPAC, a special purpose acquisition company. So
I knew that. I just wanted to help out. I wanted to help out the listeners.
It's a blank check company. And so I believe the company that went public first as a blank check was called Deep. It was like Deep Medicine Acquisition Company. And then what they did is they took True Golf public. And so it's a reverse. People that actually know this better than I do are gonna roast me on this, and that's fine, because I am not an expert in SPACs.
But that won't be me.
It's like a reverse acquisition. So they call them blank check companies. Like Tiger came out with a SPAC like a year and a half ago, and he's done nothing with it yet. But what you're doing as a SPAC is you're essentially going to acquire a company and bring them public. They were hot during COVID, 2021. People made a lot of money off them, but I don't think they performed relatively well after they went public.
Got it. So we've got the indoor golf, the indoor experience, and that's just growing. You wonder, like, you see those commercials of virtual golf once we've run out of all the land, or we can't service the land, and, you know, some sort of dystopian future. We're headed that way, I guess. I mean, it's never going to replace the real experience, but do you, like, envision a future where the majority of our golf is played on a screen?
Well, that's a really good question, Tom, because NGF would say, yes, it's already almost there, right?
Really?
I mean, if we look at off-course golf, you know, there's more people playing off-course golf than on-course golf. And in 2022, there were 6 million people that played simulator golf versus 25 million that played on green grass. So I don't envision that. Here's why. You know, people like to look at South Korea as this shining star for golf simulators. And I always caution them on that's a market that's not easy to replicate for two reasons. One is South Korea has essentially run out of land to build new golf courses. And so the reason why indoor golf and golf simulators are so popular is because as the game grows for them, there is no land to build and there's no tee times available. And so we don't have that problem in North America of land to build golf courses. So I think that green grass golf will continue to be, you know, the favorite versus like playing golf in a simulator. However, I do believe that we will continue to see different innovations, companies, and technology come out of golf simulator spaces.
Yeah, it's getting better and better. I mean, gosh, the new goggles and all that you know, all that stuff. It's going to be really interesting. I mean, I could see in the near future where caddies are walking around in the new, in their goggles, just getting the yardages and the wind. It's all right there, and you know, it's fascinating stuff. One of those innovations that's become quite popular, and you've written a little bit about, lighted par three courses. I've not done it. I've been near a couple, and I haven't gotten to do it. What's going on there? What's the popularity, the economics? Is that a big growth area?
This is one of my favorite things right now in golf. There's only 60 lighted golf courses in the United States, and there's 15,000 golf courses. So just think about that. Now, I don't think it makes sense everywhere. And what I mean by that is I think it makes sense for a warmer southern climate to do lighted par threes. And here's why I say that is, if we look at grass clippings in Tempe, Arizona, it's hot in the summer, right? And people don't want to get beat down by the sun and play golf. But so what they can do with the lights is they can flip the lights on at 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock, and they can have 3 hours of tee times. Mm-hmm. And they can have a revenue generator right there with the sun down. And that's very unique. Also in the winter, you know, now they have tee times from 7 a.m. essentially to 9 or 10 p.m. versus a traditional golf course last tee times 3 to 4. And so they increase their revenue quite significantly. Now, in a northern state like Iowa, you know, we don't have golf in the winter. So I don't think that we would see the same unit economics out of that, obviously. But in a southern state, say Arizona, California, Florida, Texas, Carolinas, maybe Tennessee, like I think it is a huge opportunity for somebody to come in and kind of commercialize the space a little bit, use the entertainment model that Topgolf has done so well with, and kind of apply it to the lighted par threes.
How well is Topgolf doing? Are they just killing it? I went to my first Topgolf recently, and I kind of liked it. And I think it's great for, I don't know if it's great for like a hardcore golfer or if you want to practice or something like that, but man, like for a family or for people who don't play, it's just, it was a very positive experience.
Yeah. And you'll find that like generally the hardcore golfer doesn't matter what your handicap is, but if you play a couple times a week, 2, 3, 4 times a week, you're generally not going to like Topgolf because you're like, it's not the same for me. And that's not Topgolf's demographic. Like they're not going after that person. They're going after what kind of you just described a little bit, the family. They're competing against bowling, movie night, restaurant night, date night, whatever it may be. Topgolf was doing really well until, you know, last quarter, but Q3 of 23, they didn't do so well. So Their issue is they're to grow, they're opening new venues, which requires a significant amount of capital, you know, between $20 and $40 million. And their same venue sales prior to Q3 of 23 had grown for 7 straight quarters, which was very solid. Well, their same venue sales now dipped in Q3. And so, you know, at some point they're going to saturate the market and you can't open more Topgolfs, right? So that needs to grow 2, 3, 4% a year, to make returns and to make a good investment. And as the same venues decline, that's a little bit of a I wouldn't say concern, but it's something that they need to keep an eye on. And they'll report here probably in the next 2 to 4 weeks of their Q4 numbers, and we'll see how they did in Q4. And they were forecasting Q4 not to be good either for Topgolf. But let's separate the two, I guess, from a business standpoint and a golf standpoint. I love Topgolf because I think it's great for the business. Topgolf has introduced a lot of people to the game, got them on green grass golf courses. They bought apparel, they bought shoes, they bought equipment. I think that's really good for the game. Now, the business side right now is maybe not as good as it should be. So I think both can be kind of true at the same time.
It's interesting, though. So what are they contributing that downturn to? Because in what I've been reading from you, which we can talk about as well, is the place that golf is in, and generally a pretty good place right now.
Yeah, and they mostly attributed that to corporate events. And so corporate events were down for the third quarter. They had some heat issues in the southeast. So again, I don't think it's something to be super concerned about as companies, you know, tighten their belts a little bit, possibly to make budget at the end of the year. In Q3, sometimes people start to do that just to look ahead. And I'll be kind of curious to see where they land at Q4 and for their full year here in a few weeks.
So, yes, so we shall see. So give us that overlook. Give us that view of your perspective on golf's trajectory in the 4 years since COVID. Is there data out there to suggest whether this was sort of a one-time boom, or is it something that's lasting? Where are we in golf?
Well, I don't think golf has probably ever been better. We were all kind of curious and nervous in 2021. We thought the bump would probably go back down, and it has not. And so I can just give you some numbers from NGF, which NGF does an incredible job compiling reports every year on participation. And in 2019, there was 34 million total golf participants in the United States. In 2023, there was 45 million. So we've added 10 million since COVID. Wow. And that's on course and off course. You know, and as I've been riding for 2.5 years kind of in this COVID boom, I was wondering the same thing. When is it going to slow down? When is it going to slow down? And, you know, I'd write about a company and, you know, I would get the usual comments, you know, the bubble will burst at some point, and it hasn't yet. And I think that they've been able to, you know, they've been able to keep the base from COVID and then also continue to grow on top of that. Now, at some point, like any industry, we will see it will be cyclical. We will see a down year. We will see a tough year. However, I think golf is an incredible spot going forward. The amount of young people getting in the game, the amount of junior golfers in the game, women. And if you look at YouTube, what that's doing for golf is actually quite interesting. So I think golf's in a fantastic spot right now. And a lot of it has to do, obviously, with COVID. And then I think there's independent media companies, which I attribute a lot of the growth to as well, getting people interested in the game.
Do you think that's what it is? So, I mean, yeah. So if we're talking about 10 million players in growth since the COVID boom, it's YouTube. It's podcasts. It's yeah. All the, you know, so how do you account for that's a significant number. How do you account for it?
I think it's three things really, right? We have COVID, we have golf entertainment, and then we have, I'm a huge believer in independent media, YouTube, what you guys are doing. But if you look at like Good and Foreplay, Bob Does Sports, their YouTube channels are crazy. And just for a crazy example here is, and I need to research this to kind of have more information, but on Wednesday night, Good streamed a live event on YouTube at Grass Clippings in Tempe under the lights par 3 tournament, and they had a ton of fans out there. It looked awesome. They had I don't know what it peaked at. When I looked, they had 88,000 live viewers. That blows my mind to think about. So I think that's a huge part of the game. The younger generations, the younger folks, they like getting on YouTube. They like watching these YouTube channels, and I think it gets them interested in the game.
Yeah, and it's been a huge opportunity for, as you say, independent media. as YouTube or podcasting or whatever may have been overlooked by the traditional providers of golf. Now, talking about that entertainment angle of golf, you've written about TGL as well and your thoughts on TGL, which I think were really interesting. So first, remind people, people have heard of TGL. I'm not sure people know what it really is, aside from that they had some problems with the venue. So what is TGL meant to be, and what are your thoughts on it from an economic standpoint?
Okay, and I ate a lot here. Like, I ate a lot of crow. I got burned on this one because, you know, I was looking at the numbers. You know, I was pretty bullish on why TGL will be successful. Now, we need to determine what does successful mean. And, you know, being on ESPN for 2 hours a week, you know, I was thinking successful 2 to 3 million viewers, which is essentially a little bit better than an NBA game. So they get to fill their inventory at ESPN, and I think that's successful. Now, the reason why I think it's going to be successful is it follows that golf entertainment play. And also Tiger Woods. And I'll just give you, if Tiger is playing in the Masters, which I think is a good metric to look at. But if Tiger plays in the Masters, Sunday at Augusta is like 13.2 million. If he's not playing, it's 11 million. Now, that's the average over the last few years. And so you automatically get the Tiger bump if he's playing. And also, I believe that it's going exactly for this. The demo is exactly the YouTube golfer, the off-course golfer. The off-course golfer, from a demographic standpoint, skews younger, and it's more in line female male, whereas on-course golf, there's a wider gap. And so I think they're just aligns up with their demo. You get the Tiger bump. And then the rise of golf entertainment, simulator golf, is obviously a huge play there. Now, I ate a lot for that because I was obviously very wrong in the sense that they didn't launch in, you know, last month. But we'll see what happens in 2025.
Yeah, I mean, you're only wrong for
a year.
It's delayed. Whether you're right or wrong has somewhat been delayed.
Yeah.
But you're right. I mean, if Tiger was on ESPN and the, you know, during sort of a slow time in sports, and I'm gonna flip it on.
Oh yeah, you
know, and see what it's about, I guess. Whether people will stick around, whether it's a good, I don't know. As you say, remains to be seen. You mentioned the off course golfer though, and that's like a really interesting category to me. How does the off course golfer impact green grass golf, right? Is there a crossover? Like, does the off-course golfer make any difference for, like, if you're operating a golf course, a public golf course, or does it make any difference to what's going on at your private club? I'm not sure. Like, so when you look at these numbers and you say an increase in 10 million players, is that flowing to public courses? Is that building up waiting lists of private courses, maybe all those things, but I imagine the on-course golfer is going maybe one place more than the other.
Right.
The off-course golfer, rather.
Yeah, in 2019, green grass golfers were 24 million, and 2023, it's 26.5. So you've seen, you know, 2.5 million increase. And 2019, there was, call it 10 million off-course, and now there's 18 million off course. So the growth is coming from off course golf. Now, how does the off course golf impact the on course golf? It's a great question. And a lot of operators and investors I've talked to are trying to solve this problem. And here's why: is Topgolf is this huge funnel, right? Okay, so how do we bring these people down to green grass? Because that is the biggest challenge of, once somebody comes into a Topgolf and they get interested, how do we bring them down to play green grass golf? There's a gap between off course and on course. And what we talked about a little bit earlier was lighted par threes. And I think lighted par threes are a little bit of a gap there. We're playing real golf, hitting real golf shots outside, yet it's under the lights possibly, or you could play in the day, but under the lights, and there's a community and entertainment aspect to it. Music, food, concerts, whatever it may be. So I think the lighted par three done right is a gap and a bridge from off course to on course golf right now.
That's a good point. And maybe that has something to do with the sort of boom in the popularity of short courses, whether they're lit or not. As you know, if you're going to Pinehurst and you don't play golf, you can still go to the putting course or the cradle. So I guess having those, it's an interesting thing to think about, like having those bridges, because I was talking with someone the other day about like the way you used to become a golfer was, and I don't want to date myself, but in my day, you were either probably a caddy, or your mom and dad played golf.
Yep.
And now it's like, oh, my buddy sent me this video on YouTube and we're going to go roll out to Topgolf. The issue is, how do you get someone from Topgolf, as you say, to the golf course? So these bridges, I think, are really, whether it be a putting course or a lighted par three course, it's really, it's interesting to think about how we do that.
Yeah. And you bring up a great point, Tom. It's like in my idea list to talk about the new golfer's journey to becoming a golfer versus when I was growing up or when you were growing up, it's much different.
Well, you were out there hitting balls into the cornfields.
Yeah.
Now, was the corn high while you were doing this or was it cut down?
You know, I always remember it as being, you know, they rotated every year. In Iowa, most fields are rotated between soybeans and corn. So I don't remember it ever being tall when we were hitting balls in there, but
probably find more balls during soybean year.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. And I just remember the bucket, you know, my dad, we'd take out the bucket and we'd fill them back up. So, but yeah, I mean, just the journey is much different today than it was, a while back. The statistics on a junior golfer has about a 25% chance likely to play golf if their parent played. So if your parent plays golf, you're 25% likely to go play golf. I don't know what that number was, you know, in the 90s or the 80s or the 70s.
Right.
To me, that surprised me today. That seemed like it was a little low, you know.
It feels low.
Yeah. And so, but there's new people being introduced in different ways. And like Youth on Course, for example, is posting record numbers right now with juniors playing. And I think that they're doing an excellent job on getting juniors to play that parents maybe didn't play.
Yeah.
And so the journey is just different. And I think that's good.
It is good. And we are big fans of Youth on Course at the Golfers Journal. Get out there and support them by doing 100 holes in a day or whatever way you can support Youth on Course, because they're underwriting youth golf rounds, giving the chance for young golfers to play anywhere for $5. We are awesome. We're a proud participant at Sullivan County Golf Club as well. So that is a great bridge to golf as well. And some of the other stuff I've been reading on your Substack, again, Perfect Putt, highly recommended. You talk a little bit about the effect of LIV's impact on college golf, PGA Tour U. What has been in the economics of LIV and the PGA Tour? That's very sort of messy. But what are the impacts that you're seeing that LIV has had on so many other parts and areas of golf?
Which is always a touchy subject right now because it's so divisive in the golf game. If you just mention LIV or you just mention PGA Tour, you know, people get so grumpy and you know what? That's fine. I've not taken a stance and I refuse to take a side because I just talk about the business side, right?
You're looking at the numbers, man.
Yeah.
Here's
what I'll say is that golf is one of the most unique sports out there. If you're the best college basketball player, you're going to get drafted number one overall and you're essentially guaranteed a contract. Golf is not that. And Jordan Spieth, when he came out, he had some sponsors exemptions. He wasn't guaranteed a PGA Tour card. He had some sponsors exemptions, and he rolled those, played well, kept rolling those to get special temporary membership, and then won the deer on special temporary membership, which ultimately gave him his card. He's never lost it since. So that's a very rare case of how to earn your card. Scottie Scheffler goes through Korn Ferry Tour to get his card. That was more, that's more of a likely play these days. And so golfers weren't guaranteed anything, which I always found sort of strange. Then again, golf's this great meritocracy, is so it's been described. And if you look at Brooks Koepka, won three times his senior year in college, didn't have any sponsors exemptions. They're exceedingly rare to have those sponsors exemptions. So he goes over to Europe to play on the Challenge Tour, and then rises to the European Tour, and then starts to play PGA Tour, and the rest is history. That's the meritocracy that the tour likes. There was no threat. They didn't need to provide, you know, status to college golfers, because there was no threat, and they would eventually find their way if they were good enough. And so LIV, you know, PGA Tour U was announced in 2020, a year before LIV played their first tournament, which PGA Tour U I'm a huge fan of. Essentially what it means is they rank the seniors, or not necessarily seniors, you have to be a four-year college golfer, and they rank you. And at the end of the year, you get some tour status. And the first year it came out was Korn Ferry Tour status. So you're telling me the best college golfer gets to go play on the Korn Ferry Tour, which average earnings in 2022 were $71,000. So it just doesn't seem, I don't want to say fair because I'm not sure that's the right word, but it just doesn't seem right. It seems kind of silly. So LIV comes on, they immediately sign three guys from college teams. One had played at 5 years, and then the other two were in their middle of their college careers. And so the PGA Tour then makes two changes. If you win PGA Tour U, now you get PGA Tour status. Also, they came up with the accelerated program where you don't have to be in school for 4 years. So I'm rambling a lot here, but what I think is interesting is that now the best college golfer has options. Mm-hmm. You can go to the PGA Tour if like Ludwig did, and you're guaranteed $500,000 as a rookie, and I'm sure he also got a tens of millions of dollar offer from LIV, and so now he's got money to go play golf outside of the sponsor money. Okay, I don't want to take that into consideration, outside of the sponsor money, and we never have had that before. And I think it's me being a former college golfer, although I wasn't good. I think that's really important that we have that opportunity, because then it'll make the college game better. If it makes the college game better, then it'll make the junior game better. And so then I think we'll start to see better talent if these guys are guaranteed some sort of money. And, you know, I think LIV generally is overpaying for the talent. Now, that doesn't mean that it's not – I'm still happy that some guys are getting these guarantees and these offers, because it's forced the change of the PGA Tour to bring in new ideas for PGA Tour U, which I'm a huge fan of PGA Tour U.
Well, it's like you said, it is good for college golf, right? If you feel like, okay, excelling in golf in college, sticking around for 4 years, so I'm going to have to also go to class. So there's a lot of upside to that arrangement, and big. A lot of positivity there. I was reading you writing about the cost. I thought this was really interesting, the cost of building golf courses. Mm. Because there's so, and I want to touch on this because I think it relates to everything we've been talking about in terms of the boom or increased play. It is a time of golf development. New courses, after a long stall in new courses being built, now we're in a time of, I mean, architects seem pretty busy. There are a lot of projects here, there, and everywhere. But, you know, and people may daydream about, well, what if I got some folks together and got some land, and how would this work? How much does it cost to build a golf course?
You need tens of millions. Red Feather, I wrote about Red Feather in Lubbock, Texas.
Right.
Which J.J. Killeen, former PGA Tour guy, is the president, and there's an investor there as well, Brad, and it's really unique. So they had King Collins come in, and they spent about $15 million, and that doesn't include the clubhouse and the casitas that they're building. It looks absolutely fabulous. Land costs, obviously, you're going to have to go somewhere that's good land for golf, and that land's not necessarily high cost. Like Iowa, you're looking at like $10,000 to $12,000 an acre. You go out to like rural, maybe Nebraska and the Sand Hills, where the land use isn't that important. Maybe just cattle graze, you're gonna get probably a lesser price. So to do it right, you probably need $20-25 million. Now you can certainly do it for less.
$25 million.
Yeah, it's yeah.
Crushing all our hopes and dreams. That seems like a lot.
It's a lot of money. It's my dream to own a 9-hole golf course in Iowa. And I know that's a weird dream because it's not like a profitable business, but I love these little 9-hole courses. And there was quite a few of them for sale. I've been looking for like 5 years just for fun. And there was, 5 years ago, you could pick one up for like $300,000.
Right.
Now there's no chance. I mean, now you're looking at 700,000 to 800,000 for these 9-hole rural golf courses. Just that. And they're probably not even turning a profit. If they're probably close to turning a profit, let's just put it like that.
Yeah. You're probably paying whether you're even paying for the business or the land or what at that number. Yep.
Exactly.
That's the question. So but that seems all right. So if I can get the land, there's gotta be cheaper ways to do it, right? If I can get some cheaper land, how many acres do I need? You can probably get away with a golf course. I mean, they're great 18-hole golf courses built on, 100 acres, less?
Yeah. You probably need about 150, 200 acres if you really want to try to scale down your price. And then, it really has to do with architect and how much land you're moving. Like, to rent those D8 dozers, you're paying thousands of dollars a week. And then you have diesel fuel on top of that. And depends how much you're going to shape it. Like, if you're not doing a ton of shaping, not running a ton of equipment, your price will come down. Go with maybe an up and comer designer, an architect. That could save you some money as well.
All right, so you can save a little money there. Learn to drive a dozer, shape it yourself. Get some people to pitch in. It's just crazy, because some courses when you think about those numbers, like courses that we featured in the Golfers Journal, and one of our best friends at the Golfers Journal, the Carn Links in Western Ireland, in County Mayo, where we'll be going this year with the Broken Tee Society, which is very exciting. You think about how that golf course was built. They raised money having bake sales, and farmers volunteered their time with shovels. They had almost no equipment, and they just sort of found the golf course and kind of mowed some parts of it and went and played golf. I mean,
that's awesome.
The original, it's crazy to think, the original golf courses, to build them cost zero because you went and played golf in a field. I mean, someone had to cut a hole. So what are the, so you mentioned the equipment, the fuel. What are those like costs people don't consider when they're thinking about what it takes to build a golf course?
Well, irrigation is incredibly expensive.
Ah, yes.
Just to get a good irrigation
system. And also unnecessary.
Yeah. I mean, if you do like retention ponds and which I think a lot of new courses are doing, they're being really smart with how they conserve water. But, irrigation, 1 to 1.5 right there. I mean, just to put the heads in and then lay the pipe. That's a certainty. But look, you look at Sand Hills in Nebraska. That's well known for basically being built, I won't say for nothing, but incredibly cheap. They didn't do a ton of shaping, and the soil is just perfect for greens and for golf courses. So, I think finding a really good piece of land is huge, but then how much earth are you actually going to move I don't know if a lot of people really want to move a ton of earth these days, but yeah. That's a huge cost in going into that.
It's almost like if you want to do it right, like, I don't know, showing some sort of Lynx bias where it's like, okay, the land is what it is and you don't need irrigation, let it go brown. You can hand water the greens. And it's like you're almost better off doing it for less. But then again, that takes a pretty educated golfer to understand that you're doing some, maybe creating a better golf experience than what they're seeing, the lush, green, lovely, which is expensive to make and expensive to maintain. On the topic of money and raising money. You wrote recently about something called the Old Tom Venture Club. I thought that was pretty fascinating. Tell me what they're doing.
Yeah, and I'm really excited about this because, like, they're essentially an investor, right? And so they're golf specific, and we don't necessarily have golf specific investment firms for, you know, consider the tens of billions of dollars the golf industry is worth, and we don't really have these. You know, the PGA of America did something really smart with EP Golf Ventures, where they have they partner with Elysian Park Ventures, and they are investing in companies. And then also we have 8AM Golf, who does some investing as well. What Old Tom's doing right now is they've created a syndicate, and it's really interesting. So you have to pay like a one-time fee to get in the syndicate, and they'll go out and they'll vet. They think they're probably going to vet around 100 companies this year in the growth stage, and they'll invest in 8 is their plan. And so they'll come back to their syndicate members and they'll say, all right, we're going to invest X amount in this company. You can write a check or you don't have to write a check. You can sit out all 8 if you want, being a syndicate member. So they're specifically investing in golf companies. And I think what's really positive about this is that the more money we have coming into the golf space is better, but also we need to have founders have exits. And this is their theory, which I fully bought in on, is if founders have exits, then they'll go in and they will build something again in the golf space. Now, that's not a certainty, but there's a high probability that that happens. If they do that, then we have more disruption. We have more innovation in the golf space, which is, I think, a positive for everybody. So I'm really excited that we've got some people that have identified the space for opportunity that aren't necessarily in golf. One of the co-founders in Old Tom was not in the golf space, and he identified it as an opportunity to invest in. So I think that's a really good positive for the space and the industry going forward.
And it's exciting. Very cool.
Yeah.
Now, in the boom we've talking about and the increase in play in the numbers, one thing I just did want to touch on is golf, in your view, becoming, and I guess I'm talking about green grass golf, is it becoming more accessible or less accessible? Where's the growth been in terms of at golf courses that would be public or semi-private versus investment in golf courses that are not?
I mean, I would probably wager to say, and I don't have any of this data, but mm-hmm. from the people that I've talked to, and the people that I receive comments from on social media, is that golf has become less accessible. Okay. Tee times are more expensive. It's more difficult to get a tee time. I don't know this for certain, but I know if we look at the courses that are being built, you know, Tree Farm, Old Barnwell, Red Feather, you know, those are all private golf courses. And Landman in Nebraska is a public resort. Sand Valley's obviously got a couple going on, public resort. I'm sure there are renovations going on at Munis. I don't know of any like public golf courses going into cities and being built. I know there's some renovations going on, but I'm sure it's happening, but we probably need more of it to take some of the demand down. Right. Because these golf courses that are being built aren't necessarily relieving the demand. I don't know if the industry is a little gun shy, Tom, because of what happened in 2008. I'm sure that they are, but it would certainly be nice to see more public daily fee courses being built in larger metro areas to relieve some of the demand. And I'm sure it's happening. I'm just not seeing it as prominently as these private destination courses.
Yeah, you don't hear, if it's happening, you're not hearing a lot about it. I mean, there's a lot of buzz about the park in Florida. Mm-hmm. That's very exciting. There's buzz here in Philadelphia about Cobbs Creek coming back. And there's other places where things are happening here and there. But when you think about golf course development, construction, what's going on with golf courses right now, you're talking about higher end resorts or private clubs generally. So opportunity there, perhaps. I would say yes. Speaking of opportunity, Jared, I can't thank you enough for your time. This has been fascinating, and I want you to do that 6 months of research for the Golfers Journal and do those stories. We'd love to see some of what you're doing in our pages, and I know our our listeners and subscribers would enjoy it as well. Opportunity. Areas for someone who's listening and thinking, man, I'm at a point in my life where I want to get into golf, or I'm just starting out in my professional life and I want to get into golf. What are the areas that you think, other than writing about the business of golf, because you have that covered, that would be opportunity areas for someone to get into the golf game?
This is a great question, and I think that there's a lot of different ways to look at it. Find something that's having a high cohort of growth, and then create a niche product off of that. And I'll give you an example. My former college teammate and my best friend, Tyler Johnson, has created a toddler golf bag. Okay, it's for 2 to 5 year olds, and he can't keep them in stock. They sell within 2 to 5 minutes of when he releases them. And that's interesting to me, because as an entrepreneur, you would think that the total addressable market isn't huge. And it's probably right. It's not a $50 or $100 million company. However, that one of the fastest cohorts in golf, of growth in golf, is juniors. And we don't see a lot of companies coming in with junior stuff and toddler stuff, right? The junior market's kind of been controlled by US Kids Golf for a while. And at that is US Kids Golf, it's probably about 5 to 7 years old where the stuff is really valuable. Under that, 2 to 5, 2 to 6, there's not anything there. So he identified something within the golf space that was able to work for him. And I think the same can be said about apparel. Although I believe apparel on the men's side is probably oversaturated. I don't think it's oversaturated on the women's side. I think there can be something done there. Or is it juniors as well? So I think if we're going to look at the golf space, find a niche that's growing quickly and try to create a product of value in that niche. That could even be indoor golf. It could be golf simulators. It could be an add-on, not creating an actual simulator, but maybe an add-on product or software feature, et cetera. So there's a lot of different spaces, but I think it's really important to find a niche within golf right now. I think it's big enough to find a niche and have a successful business.
Wise words and great advice. Thank you, Jared. Again, where can everyone find you and check out your newsletter?
Yeah, it's perfectputt.substack.com. It's a weekly newsletter for free. It goes out Monday morning at 7:47 Central Time, whether I like that or not. And yeah, Tom, I really appreciate you having me on. I'm a huge fan of the Golfer's Journal. Get every magazine in the mail every quarter. And at some point, I'm hoping to make it to an event. So again, really appreciate having me on.
Yes, please do. Appreciate the support. And it's been a great discussion. We'll talk again soon. Play some golf, I hope.
Right on.
Thanks for listening, everyone. And if you enjoyed this episode, we strongly encourage you to become a member of the Golfer's Journal, or if you already are, to share it with your friends. As a reader-supported publication, we couldn't do it without you. We also couldn't do it without the help of our partners, and they are Titleist, Scotty Cameron, FootJoy, Linksoul, Omega, Charles Schwab, and BMW. We'll see you next time on the Golfer's Journal podcast.